Hello and welcome to our first episode in our new series of In Our Welling Time, supporting the CIE 19th Century History Exam. Today, we're going to be diving into one of the core topics you'll be studying, the American Civil War, its causes, how the conflict unfolded, and the major consequences that shaped the United States. My name is Mr. Guttridge, and I'll be your host for this discussion, and I'm delighted to be joined by two of my colleagues.
It's Mr. Loosley.
And Mrs. Whitelaw.
Who will be helping us to unpack the big questions you'll need to understand for your GCSE course. So let's get started with the causes then. Firstly, Mrs. Whitelaw, how central was slavery to the breakdown of relations between North and South?
It was crucial. I mean, it's a huge long-term issue between the two sides. Slavery hadn't been part of the economy of the North for a long time and was essentially abolished between 1780, 1804, whereas the South had a huge reliance on cotton, which made up to 42% of all US exports. And the North Sea, this is a hugely unfair advantage. Southern businessmen can make profits without having to pay wages. There's also that sense that plantation owners dominate all of Southern society, politics. It's the real backbone of the Southern economy. So there's that sense that you have the North, on the other hand, industrializing. They have a growing population. Southerners unhappily about the tariff export on imports they're bringing in for benefiting Northern manufacturers. And so these differences are really kind of exacerbated by the slavery issue. And you have things like the Three-Fifths Compromise that gives Southerners that disproportionate political influence, and that increases the Northern fears of slave power. Added to this, you have abolitionists and their growing power. Even though they take a while to have an effect, it really heightens tensions, particularly things like Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin in 1852. That sold 2 million copies, hugely raises awareness in the North and angers the South. You've then got westward expansion, and this question over whether slavery should spread west, and that feeling of, is it going to threaten economic opportunities of free white people? So this kind of makes it really politically tense and a pressing issue after 1819.
Thank you very much, Mrs. Whitelaw. What about sort of linked to this is the idea of compromise. And why did the attempts at compromise by the politicians running the United States, like the Missouri Compromise and the 1850 Compromise, ultimately fail to prevent conflict?
Well, so one way of looking at this is that I suppose ask whether they failed. Certainly not at first. So the Missouri Compromise and the 1850 Compromise, they failed to prevent conflict, perhaps in the long term, but at the time, I think they felt actually they had settled the issue. So we need to ask ourselves, if we understand why they ultimately failed to prevent conflict, it's like what happens after the 1850 Compromise, which means that divisions between North and South grow, and tensions between slave owners and abolitionists get worse, such that when the Kansas-Nebraska Act is passed in 1854, there's so little trust that we then see fighting taking place in Kansas through Bleeding Kansas. I think part of that is the work of the abolitionists that Mrs. Whitelaw just mentioned. For Southerners, they saw the work of abolitionists as an assault on their way of life. And the abolition of slavery posed, for many Southerners, I guess, an existential threat to the whole Southern economy and Southern society. Such that when the Kansas-Nebraska Act is passed, there's that fight over Kansas, over whether Kansas will be a slave state or a free state. And that thing really illustrates the breakdown of trust between the abolitionists on the one side and the Southern slave owners on the other. And we see that the violence there quickly spirals. I mean, there's a kind of a chain of events after 1854, which widens the gap, I guess, between North and South and makes compromise increasingly difficult to find. The violence in Kansas, we have John Brown's actions during Bleeding Kansas and the massacre at Pottawatomie Creek. There's the beating of Senate Sumner in the Senate, which shows really that the issues in Kansas are now bleeding into the heart of the country in Washington, D.C. Ultimately, you then find in 1859, with John Brown's raid at Harper's Ferry, that North and South, or opinion in North and South, is becoming increasingly divided, with people in the North celebrating John Brown, even if they criticized his methods, nevertheless feeling like his heart was in the right place, while Southerners felt that John Brown was lawless and a traitor and trying to foment a slave revolt. And I guess the divided response to those kinds of acts of violence, where you see people in the North cheerleading on one side and Southerners supporting the other side of any kind of conflict, means that these compromises, in their attempt to try and marry together, to sort of resolve the problems of Western expansion and the issue of slavery, ultimately fail, such that when Abraham Lincoln is elected, even though he is saying that he does not intend to abolish slavery in the states where it currently exists, nevertheless, Southern states don't believe him, and that prompts the move to secession.
Thank you very much. So it was interesting. So things were getting more and more tense. We've got a series of events like the Compromise of 1850, obviously the publication of Uncle Tom's Cabin, the Kansas-Nebraska Act, the Bleeding Canvas, the Dred Scott case, the raid on Harper's Ferry, and then Lincoln is elected president.
Yes. I mean, obviously our conversation so far has been based upon the idea that slavery was inherently divisive and necessarily then a cause of war. I guess it's worth considering, if we're going to answer the question of how central was slavery to causing the war, the ways in which I see slavery also in some respects acted as a glue between North and South. It's very easy to paint North and South as divided from the very beginning. But as I was saying, the Missouri Compromise back in 1820 actually was followed by, 30 years of calm from that point of view. So not until the 1850 Compromise, we then see this issue reemerge. Slavery actually, while it divided abolitionists against slave owners in the South, many people in the North are invested in slavery. Slavery acts as an economic glue between North and South. Even though slavery isn't owned in the North, we have people who are benefiting from the cotton produced in the South by enslaved people. We've mentioned the abolitionists, and it's easy to see them as this very divisive movement that's very influential. But actually, you can also consider the abolitionists to be largely a minority opinion. And the majority opinion in the North was one of trying to seek an accommodation with the South. I think the issue becomes worse in the 1850s, partly because the abolitionists become more willing to use force. We see that in Bleeding Kansas. We see that with John Brown. But also that the Fugitive Slave Act in 1850 makes slavery a very real issue, a real present issue for white Northerners who, while they may not like slavery, were quite happy to leave it where it lay and leave it while it existed in the South. So the Fugitive Slave Act, by forcing white Northerners to join in slave hunts, to try and track down enslaved people who had escaped to the North, meant that if you were a white Northerner who was morally opposed to slavery, but not minded to oppose slavery in any active sense, was now being made to collude and collaborate in the institution of slavery by being forced to hunt down enslaved people who otherwise you felt quite sympathetic for. And I think for white Northerners, in the 1850s, slavery increasingly feels like it's a threat not simply to black freedom, but also to white freedom, because white Northerners are being forced to do things against their will by tracking down enslaved people. And I think you start to see two conspiracy theories emerge in the 1850s. One is that the South feels like the North is determined to root out slavery wherever it exists, including in states where it currently exists. And they see abolitionists as merely the tip of the iceberg, such that they feel like no compromise with the North is going to be possible, because ultimately the North will want to get rid of slavery. And you can see that when they don't trust Abraham Lincoln when he's elected. At the same time, in the North, you see another conspiracy theory emerging, this belief in a slave power, whereby people believe that there's white Southerners who own slaves who are not content merely for slavery to exist in the current Southern states, but want to see it extended, A, into the West, to the new states that have been emerging, but then B, into the north and make the whole country a slave-owning country, which feels like a threat to the culture and the, I guess, the morals of the north. And I think those two conspiracy theories mean that from 1850 onwards, we start to see this growing tension. And I think attempts by compromise by political moderates, including Abraham Lincoln, for instance, and Stephen Douglas, fail because there's radicals on both sides who are willing to shed blood and see no room for compromise. And that almost drags everyone else into the conflict.
Thank you very much. Let's hear Mrs. Whitelaw. Just can you expand a little bit more about Abraham Lincoln and his role in as a turning point for the United States?
I think his election really brings things to a head in terms of the different sized attitudes towards the Union. He sees the Union as permanent. A lot of people, particularly in the South, see it as voluntary. So his election kind of forces the issue and gets the two sides to decide where they stand. There's also the fact that his election, he's arguing on a platform of higher tariffs, which is going to help the northern side more, and free homesteads for settlers in the West. So from that, you get him winning 40% of the popular vote. And it's really entirely on northern votes. And within days of his election, you get South Carolina seceding. So it really is in a direct response to his election, and that really pushes the issue and brings it all to a head.
Yeah, so we've got a nice, thank you, we've got this nice kind of long-term, short-term causes of the Civil War, the long-term sort of the slavery and the economy, and economic differences rather, and then we've got the 1850s, the compromises, sorry, the 1850 compromise and these rising tension in the mid to late 50s that Mr. Loosley talked about. And then we've got almost the trigger, which was Lincoln's election and what he represented. Should we move on now to the fourth question, which is, unless there's anything else we've done on the causes?
I would just add about the significance of Abraham Lincoln's election. I mean, Mrs. Whitelaw mentioned the fact that he wins and votes simply in the North. And of course, that's significant because up to that point, both the Democrats and the Whig Party, which exists before the Republican Party, were winning votes across the country. So, you know, for a civil war to take place, what we need are two areas of the country to increasingly exist almost as separate entities. Now, we've seen how the economy was diverging, and increasingly northern economies based on manufacturing and southern economies based by agriculture. Obviously, slavery and the ownership of enslaved people is a dividing factor. But up until the 1860 election, the federal government, the presidency, people were winning control of the federal government by winning votes in the North and the South. And therefore, both sides had a government which they could see as their government. Abraham Lincoln is the first person to win the presidency with only votes in the North. So no Southerners see him as their president, particularly. And so I think the 1860 election moves us to a position where politically now, the two countries or the two sides are moving apart, which sets the scene for secession, as Mrs. Whitelaw described.
Good. Thank you. So we're in a democracy, and in a democracy, if you oppose people, you vote in a particular way. But there comes a point when the first shot is fired. Moving on now to the war itself. What factors enabled the North to win the Civil War? Mr. Loosley.
Okay, well, I think any question about why the North wins the Civil War has to consider the question of whether the North victory was inevitable based upon its apparent advantage at the beginning of the war, or whether the South could have won it. Now, if we look at the two sides at the start of the war, certainly it looks like the North have a very significant advantage. A far greater population, 22 million people in the North, there's only 9 million in the South, and of those 9 million, only 5.5 are white. We have a hugely greater industrial capacity in the North. We also have the question of the army. Most men in the regular US regular army were loyal to the Union. So the Union has a larger pool of military experience to call on. At the same time, though, while it may seem obvious, therefore, that the North are going to win, it begs the question of, well, why on earth did the South think it could win? Why would the South go so far as to try to fight the North if it's so obvious the North are going to win? And if the North has these advantages at the beginning, why does it take them so long to win? So while clearly they go into the war with this kind of economic and demographic advantage with this huge manpower, clearly that's not enough. And history is littered with examples of a country which has all the apparent resources you need to win a war, but nevertheless can't convert that into victory. And we see that early on, because clearly the Confederacy does appear to be winning most of the encounters with the North. And that helps us see then what advantages the South had, or the Confederacy had, which perhaps are less obvious. So the Confederacy obviously has the advantage of, while it is smaller, it is still than the North, it is big enough, geographically speaking, to make it very difficult to conquer and to blockade. And the North does try to blockade it with using the Navy to ban the sea. But nevertheless, there's still it's still an enormous expanse of territory the North is going to try and conquer. And obviously the South doesn't have to conquer the North. The South merely has to hold off the North until the North gives up. So in that sense, the Confederacy is in a position where if it can simply stay in the game long enough, it can simply maintain its will to resist long enough, then the hope is that morale in the North and a willingness to continue a bloody conflict in the North will ultimately fade, and then some kind of negotiated settlement can be arrived at, which, let's say, could maintain the Confederacy's independence. The other advantage that the South has is that while it doesn't necessarily have the biggest manpower, it is blessed by a concentration of very gifted military commanders, of whom the most significant is Robert E. Lee. And we see in the early war in 1861 to 62 that Robert E. Lee has the better of the military encounters against his opponent, George McClellan, who was appointed in September 1861 as a general-in-chief. Now, McClellan has a larger army, but he doesn't have the strategic brilliance that Robert E. Lee brings. And we see the first real attempt to capture the southern capital of Richmond in the Peninsula Campaign of 1862. McClellan, with a larger army, but moving far more slowly, is ultimately forced to retreat by Lee's smaller, more nimble forces, who are able to attack and move and attack and move in the series of battles called the 7 Days. We see elsewhere that the South clearly has the capacity to outthink and outmaneuver these larger northern armies. And in 1862, we then see Lee taking the fight to the North in a bid to try and convince the North to give in the shock of an invasion attempt. And it almost succeeds. And in fact, Lee only loses, really, the battle at Antietam because his battle plans were discovered in the few days before, which gave the North the advantage. And even then, the North barely manages to secure a victory. So early on, the North appears to have all the advantages, and yet it cannot seem to make it tell on the battlefield. What really will make the difference, ultimately, is a shift in the way in which the North fights the war. At first, it has McClellan, who is hesitant and cautious, but also they're fighting a limited war. Because Abraham Lincoln believes that most people in the South are not actually committed to the Confederacy and that the Confederacy has been created by a minority of slave owners, he doesn't want to alienate the ordinary people of the South. And so therefore, the North does not throw into the war the full force of its resources and the full might of its military. For instance, it doesn't seek to free the enslaved people in the South for fear of alienating ordinary Southerners. And they don't seek to destroy Southern resources and farms and what have you, again, because they don't want to alienate ordinary Southerners. But by the mid or late 1862, it's quite clear in Abraham Lincoln's mind that this limited war is not succeeding and runs the risk of exhausting the Northerners' will and the kind of the voting public's will in the North for continuing this fight against the South.
So that's a good moment to shift from the military to the political, and the turning point of the Emancipation Proclamation. You placed it in its historical context. What was it and what was its significance, Mrs. Whitehall?
So this is passed in January 1863, and through this, Lincoln frees all slaves, crucially in the Confederacy, so not slaves in the slave states that stayed loyal to the Union. This has huge consequences. So slaves are able to escape from the Confederacy. Not only does that have a huge impact on the Southern economy, it also means they've lost the sort of moral argument in terms of the war. So any potential foreign allies therefore feel they can't actively support the South because they'd then be supporting slavery. And you also get up to, I think, 200,000 Black Americans then serve in Northern armies. So it also has an impact in contributing to the war effort.
Yes, it makes the war kind of, as you say, a moral purpose. Mm. And we're right, the North might say that.
And certainly, I mean, the Emancipation Proclamation of 1863 is a key turning point. And it reflects Lincoln's willingness now to take the war to the South and fundamentally reshape Southern society by freeing the enslaved people in the South. At the same time, there's another turning point in 1863, which reflects Lincoln's new commitment to what we could describe as total war. He finds finally a general in Ulysses S. Grant who is willing to use the full weight of Northern economic military power and the weight of its population to force the South to ultimately surrender. He doesn't find them immediately. It takes time. And between Antietam in 1862 and the appointment of Ulysses S. Grant, Lee has once again invaded the North in a bid to kind of shock the North into some kind of negotiation. And is stopped at the famous Battle of Gettysburg. Though again, he's able to retreat in good order because the North lacks a leader, a general who's going to try and fully defeat the South. But at the same time as Gettysburg is taking place in July 1863, a few days later in Vicksburg, Ulysses S. Grant has come finally and fully to Lincoln's attention as a general who's willing to move his forces and seek victory at any cost by capturing Vicksburg in what is quite a bloody siege. And as a response to that, Lincoln says that he can't spare this man, Grant is a soldier who fights, unlike McClellan, who was too cautious. And with Grant's appointment, we do see a dramatic change in the Northern approach to fighting the war. He now moves for essentially an advance on all fronts to take the war into the heartland of Richmond, but also to invade Tennessee. And this puts the South under real pressure. Though at first, it doesn't appear to be leading to the quick victory, perhaps, that some of the North expect. And we certainly have this moment in the Civil War where, while militarily speaking, the South is outnumbered and on the back foot, the huge numbers of casualties that Grant is suffering with his ruthless and confrontational approach to fighting is starting to undermine the Northern will to resist. And really, once Grant's appointment is made, you could say from a military point of view, the South is heading for defeat. But there is one last opportunity it has to try and stave that off, which is the 1864 election in the North. The 1864 election is Confederacy's last chance to defeat the North, because while they can't defeat them on the battlefield, the South hopes that if in the election a candidate is elected who is willing to negotiate with the South, if Lincoln can lose this election, well then they still hope that the South can fight the North to a stalemate and negotiate a settlement. Lincoln's very worried that he's going to lose. For a time, it looks like he's going to lose. The tide in the political campaign shifts when the city of Atlanta finally falls to Northern forces, and that victory in the field transforms Lincoln's political hopes. And ultimately, actually, in the election, he wins by a landslide. At the time, it didn't look like that was going to happen. But like I said, the fall of Atlanta means that ultimately Lincoln does win. And I think with Lincoln winning the 1864 election, we have now a general in Grant, supported by Sherman, who is determined to defeating the South militarily. We've got a political leader in Lincoln who's still committed also to the total military defeat of the South. And really, from the November 1864 election onwards, it's just a matter of time before the Confederacy loses. Economically, it is struggling, massive levels of inflation. We have Sherman's march to the sea through Georgia, which is destroying the Georgian economy. Lee is losing lots of troops at this point through mass desertions. And we see that that all leads ultimately, within only a few months of Lincoln's election, to the defeat of Lee, his surrender in April 1865, and then the wider surrender of all Confederate forces in late May. So you see that in terms of the reasons for the North victory, it's not purely a case of the North strengths, but how they use them. And it's not until they're willing to use them to emancipate the slaves and to throw their military into the war with full force, is the South forced to surrender.
Let's move on now to the post-war world. I wonder, Mrs. Whitelaw, do you want to talk a bit about Reconstruction, what it was, what it was hoping to achieve, and also why did it come to an end?
So Reconstruction is really about rebuilding, healing, reuniting the nation following this time of civil war. You can really split it into three phases. So really Lincoln, very briefly before his assassination in April, and then his vice president, Andrew Johnson, who takes over up to about 1866. And several successes. So you have the 13th Amendment, which Lincoln passes in January 65, which frees all the slaves throughout the US. You have things like the Freedmen's Bureau, which is set up in March of 1865. And that's aiming to offer education, healthcare to freed people and also poor white families. And they redistribute some plantation land to a lot of those families. When Johnson takes over, he's very different from Lincoln. He's a Southerner. He very much wanted Confederation states to rejoin and be kind of free to do what they want and carry on as they were before. So he allowed former Confederacy state governments back with little interference, returns land that had been given to black people back to original plantation owners, pardons most of the soldiers, and the South take advantage of that, passing black codes, so essentially limiting the rights of black Americans. And at the same time, by the end of 1865, you've got white supremacist groups like the KKK forming and really terrorizing black Americans. And they go about trying to stop black people from voting, targeting schools. So a lot of the good work that's been set up is very quickly unraveling. You then get, between 1866, 1870, a phase where radical Republicans start to dominate. So they shift away from what Johnson's tried to do, and they want a firmer line taken against the Confederacy states. So we get, in 1866, the 14th Amendment, which brings in equal protection under the law, granting citizenship to everyone born in America. In 1867, you have three Reconstruction Acts doing things like removing state government from the South. The South is essentially placed under military rule from Union generals. They ban people who fought against the Union from voting, and there's an emphasis on protecting black rights. Then in 1868, you get the general Mr. Lewis we spoke about earlier, Grant, major Union general who becomes president, which is a great victory for the radical Republicans. In 1870, all Confederate states by that point have had to accept everything through the Reconstruction Acts, and they've rejoined. And you've got success with, you know, over 2,000 black Americans elected to government posts. We also have the 15th Amendment in 1870, and that means that every US citizen has the right to vote. So there is that real sense of success. But then after 1870, Reconstruction really starts to lose momentum. You have the Freedmen's Bureau closing in 1872, and an Amnesty Act returns all the Confederacy rights. In 1874, the Democrats win back control of Congress, and there are several Supreme Court cases the 1873 Slaughterhouse and 1876 US versus Cruikshank. And they essentially rule that the 14th Amendment doesn't give federal government power to intervene in the state voting process or to protect citizens from attack. And this allows southern states to essentially block black people from voting. And the end of Reconstruction is really marked by what's known as the Compromise of 1877. And this is where Union troops withdraw from the South in a political deal over the presidency.
Thank you very much. So again, sort of the rise and fall of reconciliation and so on as particular groups and leaders take over.
And I think a common question that people ask about Reconstruction is, why does it fail? And I guess my response to that would be, well, does it fail? I think if Reconstruction does fail, it's probably because it means different things to different people. And the aims of Reconstruction were not all shared amongst all the people who had stake in Reconstruction. If Reconstruction fails, it fails in the area of integrating black Americans fully into American life, particularly in the South. Whereas we've discussed, the actions of white supremacists and the KKK and the Supreme Court decisions mean that any gains in black American rights that are achieved in the early years of Reconstruction are rowed back. And clearly by 1877 and in the years following, black Americans continue to be second-class citizens, economically dependent through the sharecropper system on white landowners and unable to exercise their political rights. But look, from another point of view, Reconstruction can be successful if we consider its aim is to reconstruct the Union and bring the Union back together again. For those people for whom the main goal of Reconstruction was to unite the Union, and I think that is the case for, say, President Johnson, ultimately, by 1877, all we have is a country where all the states are willing to accept the amendments that led to the abolition of slavery. The right to secede is no longer claimed by any state. And what we have is, by 1877, a country which, so long as you ignore, I suppose, the experience of black Americans, white Americans have come together and are largely now willing to accept themselves all within one country. I guess this issue about what are the aims of Reconstruction, goes back to the issue before the Civil War that was dividing the North. Now, when the North went to war, did it go to war to end slavery or did it go to war to restore the Union? I think Abraham Lincoln would say, in his heart of hearts, he's there to restore the Union. And he only abolishes slavery when the situation demands it, despite the fact that he is sympathetic to enslaved people. And we see that after the war's over, while there's a great deal of commitment to try to bring the South together back with the North, what we don't see is the same level of commitment to black American rights. There's a period of time during Radical Reconstruction where the Radical Republicans are using their powers in Congress to try to create a system which does allow them equal rights. But as their strength in Congress fades, as economic problems reemerge in the North, actually by 1877, the patience and willingness of white Northerners to continue to use military force to protect black Americans in the South has faded. And that led into the 1877 compromise. So yeah, to wrap up really then, Reconstruction, I think some people will be happy with Reconstruction, ultimately, in terms of it does finally bring the Union together, though clearly it's done at the cost of black Americans remaining in second-class status.
Thank you very much. We're coming now to the near the end of our podcast on the US Civil War. Mrs. Whitelaw, if you've got a conclusion that you would like to sort of put to this story of compromise, conflict, and sort of the failure of reconciliation? Or have I just put you on the spot?
I mean, I think that the origins of this conflict, it goes right back to the foundation document of the United States with the Declaration of Independence in 1776. And, you know, with that statement over all men are created equal, it does mean that question of slavery is going to inevitably to conflict at some point. And that also creates that divide over states' rights and should the union continue. So I'd say definitely the seeds of conflict are sown very early on in the history of the United States.
And I would agree. I mean, I think that slavery is often seen as like the original sin of the Constitution. It's kind of a seed that's planted there, which appears to be under the surface and not causing too many problems. But the problem of slavery doesn't go away. And the compromises, as we saw, they try to paper over these cracks. But by the 1850s, a reckoning is coming. And I think we then see through that same story coming through radical Reconstruction and what have you, up to 1877, where ultimately slavery has gone, but now there's this uneasy compromise between the whites in America, which leave black Americans, again, in a subordinate status. I mean, I think otherwise, the other great thing about the US Civil War is just it gets us thinking about the different ways of, different perspectives and different way of looking at things. The story is always a little bit more complex than it at first appears. We think about abolitionists and how they appear to be dominating Northern public opinion when actually they form quite a minority. And you can ask questions about how much significance really were the abolitionists in the North, when I think the majority opinion is trying to seek some kind of accommodation with Southern states. And we also see the kind of political tussle, don't we, in the Reconstruction era between different visions of what the country should look like. And we can take that kind of pattern of kind of political conflict and different visions of what a country should look like and take that further into looking at current political debates in our own lives.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Loosley, Mrs. Whitelaw. We've covered today the causes, nature and consequences of the US Civil War, how resources and leadership were directed in US history from compromise to war to Northern victory and then to short-lived Reconstruction and reconciliation. Thank you for listening. We hope you found it useful.